Now let me just give you a brief reminder of Deuteronomy's structure. The first three chapters are historical in their nature. Moses goes through Israel's recent history, and he particularly emphasizes God's grace manifested toward Israel in that recent history. Then in chapter 4, he moves on to introduce the concept of ethics, the concept of law, and he gives some reasons why this concept is so important. Then in chapter 5, he articulates the law itself, the Ten Commandments. And he then moves on to the business of application, applying the Ten Commandments to those Israelites there on the brink of Canaan. And in chapters 6 to 11, it's particularly the first commandment that he's applying. The implications of the no other gods rule when it comes to raising your children, and when it comes to handling economic prosperity, and when it comes to treating properly the poor, underprivileged alien in the community. It's those issues that he explores in those chapters. But here now in chapter 12, he turns to the second commandment. And he's now elaborating and applying it. And it's with that then that we are dealing in these verses this morning. And perhaps it'd be useful just to remind you what the second commandment is. It's there in chapter 5, verse 8. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. And you may remember that we talked about this before, and what exactly that second commandment is addressing. The first commandment, of course, is addressing the worship of other gods. That's what the first commandment is about. But the second commandment isn't addressing the worship of other gods. The second commandment is about worshipping Jehovah, worshipping Yahweh, and this tempting idea that you can do that through some kind of physical object, some kind of statue, some kind of image which kind of represents Jehovah and which gives you then a helpful kind of visible focal point as you're worshipping him. It's that particular issue that the second commandment is addressing. And when we come to chapter 12 here then, Moses isn't saying here in this chapter, look Israel, Jehovah is the true God. Jehovah is the real God. Jehovah is the supreme God. He's been doing that in chapter 6 to 11. He's exhausted that theme now. Now here in chapter 12, he's saying, look Israel, now you're clear on that. Now you're absolutely clear that Jehovah is the only God to be worshipped. Now you have to understand how to worship him correctly. How to worship him properly, how to worship him appropriately. And so I just want to highlight from this chapter this morning then four principles governing Israel's worship of Jehovah. First principle, pure worship. Pure worship. You know how it is if you're going to rent a property. You have to make a choice, don't you? You can either rent a furnished property or you can rent an unfurnished property. And if you go for the first of those options then, if you rent a furnished property, then the advantage is that you don't need to worry about buying a fridge and a washing machine and a bed and all that kind of stuff. You can just use what's already there. The disadvantage is that there's that lamp in the living room which is absolutely hideous, and there's that painting on the bedroom wall which is so garish even the Tate Modern would think twice about exhibiting it. That's the disadvantage. There are those two sides of the coin, aren't there, when you decide to rent a furnished property. And it was a little bit like that for Israel. Because we've said before, haven't we, this land that God was giving Israel, the land of Canaan, it wasn't some bare, remote wilderness of a place. It was a place in which people had been living very recently. It was a place in which for many centuries human societies had been functioning. If you like, Israel was taking over a furnished property. And for Israel too, this was both a positive and a negative thing. The advantage was that there was a whole infrastructure already in place, agriculturally, industrially, architecturally. There were all kinds of things already there for them. We saw that, didn't we, back in chapter 6, I think it was. Yes, chapter 6, verses 10 and 11. A land with large, flourishing cities you did not build, houses filled with all kinds of good things you did not provide, wells you did not dig, and vineyards and olive groves you did not plant. So that was the advantage that Israel had in taking over a land that had been so recently occupied. The disadvantage, however, was that scattered all over this land were these religious sites, these shrines with their grotesque idols and their sexually suggestive sculptures and their makeshift altars stained with a mixture of blood and semen and alcohol, testimony to long, wild nights of uncurbed pagan worship. That was the disadvantage. That was the downside. That was the problem that the Israelites had entering a land which had been previously possessed by the Canaanites. But it wasn't an insurmountable problem. It was a problem that they were to do something about. And according to this passage then, there were two particular things which the Israelites were to do in regard to these Canaanite worship sites which they had inherited. First of all, they were to dismantle them. That's in verses 2 and 3. Notice particularly verse 3. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, and burn their Asherah poles in the fire. Cut down the idols of their gods and wipe out their names from those places. Now, there's nothing hugely remarkable about that. In fact, Moses has already commanded it back in chapter 7, verse 5. But that was the first thing they were to do then. They were simply to get out the sledgehammers, get out the protective goggles, and do a demolition job and knock down all that stuff. But then the second thing they were to do was renounce these places as worship sites. They were to renounce these places as worship sites. Because that, I think, is the point of this sustained emphasis here on the one place of God's appointment. You can't miss it, can you? Verse 5, but you are to seek the place the Lord your God will choose from among all your tribes to put his name there for his dwelling. To that place you must go. There bring your burnt offerings and sacrifices, and so on. Verse 7, there in the presence of the Lord your God, you and your families shall eat and shall rejoice. Go down to verse 11. Then to the place the Lord your God will choose as a dwelling for his name, there you are to bring everything I command you. Verse 12. There rejoice before the Lord your God. Verse 13. Be careful not to sacrifice your burnt offerings anywhere you please. Offer them only at the place the Lord your God will choose in one of your tribes, and there observe everything I command you. Now, it's not that Moses has some crass idea that God can't be in more than one place at once. It's rather that he doesn't want the Israelites to take over these worship sites of the Canaanites. He doesn't want them to use them. You see, it would have been a very natural thing for the Israelites to do, wouldn't it? Presumably, there were good common sense reasons why the Canaanites had chosen those particular locations. Presumably, they were accessible locations. Presumably, they were visible locations. Presumably they were peaceful and secluded locations. Presumably they were generally conducive locations to worship. And the Israelites might well have thought then, well, rather than start from scratch, we'll just take over these sites and we'll worship our God Jehovah in those former Canaanite worship sites. And it's that then that is being prevented by this stress here in this chapter, worship God only in the one place that he chooses. But it raises the question, doesn't it? What would have been so wrong if the Israelites had done that? If all the pagan apparatus in these sites has now been dismantled, if the idols and the sculptures and the altars have all gone now, if these are just bare sites now, then why shouldn't the Israelites take them over? Why shouldn't the Israelites use those places to worship their God, Jehovah? Well, I think the answer is that even without the pagan apparatus, without the idols and sculptures and altars, those places would have had dangerous mental associations for the Israelites. Whenever I go to the Christian conference that is held every August in Aberystwyth, I have rather a strange sensation. The main meetings in that conference are held in the Great Hall in the university campus. And when I was a student at Aberystwyth, I had exams in that very building, in that very room. And even though there are no lines of examination tables, even though there's no invigilators wandering around making the floorboards creak, even though there's no intimidating clock on the wall, even though I'm sitting now in a congregation of God's people listening to God's word in that room, I still can't quite get out of my mind those academic associations that the room holds for me. And I think it would have been a bit like that for the Israelites. That yes, the idols and the sculptures and the altars, they'd all gone, they dismantled those. These places didn't look like pagan worship sites anymore. Yet, in some subtle, involuntary way, worshipping God in those places, there was the danger that their conception of God would be just slightly coloured and slightly tainted by gross Canaanite ideas about deity, gross Canaanite theologies. And the Israelites weren't to allow that to happen because their worship was to be pure. Their conception of the God that they were worshipping was to be as unpolluted as it's possible for sinful people to have. And it's the same for us, isn't it? Isn't it all too easy for us to come here on a Sunday morning to worship our God, and yet our mental conception of our God is all over the place? And of course, to a degree, that's inevitable because we are sinful people and our intellects are as affected by sin as any other part of us is. But we need to be minimizing, don't we, the extent to which that is so. We need to be meditating so hard on God's own self-portrait here in the Bible, that whenever Satan zaps a suggestion about God into our minds, God is harsh and uncaring. God has lost control of this world. God is unwilling to forgive that sin of yours. God is abstract and impersonal. God is sin-friendly. Whatever it might be, immediately our mental self-defense mechanisms will spring into action. And we'll expel that suggestion, because we have such a clear view of what our God is really like as he has defined himself in his word, the Bible. It's so important that our worship is as pure as we can possibly make it at that level, that we know who this God is that we're worshiping. It was so important that the Israelites didn't take on any Canaanite ideas. It was so important that they mustn't even use these worship sites, even once the idols are all gone. And it's that important for us as well, that we have a right perception of the God we are worshipping together. That's the first thing then, pure worship. Second principle, balanced worship. Balanced worship. But what do I mean then by this? What is the balance to which I'm alluding? Well, on the one hand, Israel's worship wasn't to be over spiritual. It wasn't to be over spiritual. You see, one danger for the Israelites, and I guess the biggest danger, was that they would just emulate the Canaanites before them. And their worship would become something little distinguishable from an orgy, characterized by all kinds of overindulgence and explicit sensuality and all the rest of it. That was one big danger for the Israelites. But another danger was that they would go to the other extreme and overreact to the Canaanites. And that they would basically seek to remove any reference in their worship to anything physical and earthy. That they would make their worship this over-spiritual thing. And it's that, I think, that Moses is addressing a couple of times in this passage, in verse 7, where he says, "There in the presence of the Lord your God, you and your family shall eat and shall rejoice in everything you have put your hand to." And then again, in similar language in verse 18, that you are to, second half of the verse, you are to rejoice before the Lord your God in everything you put your hand to. In other words, you see, the Israelites' worship wasn't to take place in some artificial realm carefully sealed off from any contact with real life. No, their agricultural and technological and cultural exploits were blessings from God, weren't they? And the Israelites were to acknowledge and thank God for and be unembarrassed about all those kinds of daily real life blessings in their worship. They were to eat, they were to rejoice in all that they'd put their hand to, all that God had given them, all the blessings of normal everyday life. They were to rejoice in those things in their worship. And that's why then when you come to the Psalms, these inspired worship songs, the authors there, they talk about harvests, Psalm 65. They talk about the work of builders and city watchmen, Psalm 127. They talk about the work of a soldier, Psalm 144. "Praise be to the Lord, my rock, who trains my hands for war, my fingers for battle." You see, these people were physical as well as spiritual. They had bodies as well as souls, and they wanted both dimensions of their humanness to be reflected in their worship of God. And it's the same for us too. We have been blessed in so many ways by God. Art and sport and science and music and literature and technology. And so we could go on. All these things are God's blessings, aren't they, which we enjoy. And they're not things, therefore, which we should pretend don't exist when we come here on a Sunday morning. We should suddenly get all embarrassed about when we come here on a Sunday morning. No, part of what we are doing here on a Sunday, not the whole of what we are doing by any means, but part of what we are doing here is re-establishing and refreshing our theistic perspective on the whole of life. Relating all our everyday activities and pleasures back to the God who gives them meaning. and validity. We should thank God here in our worship for these kinds of everyday blessings. We should celebrate here in our worship the wonderful richness and variety of this world which God has made and in which he has put us. Our worship, like Israel, shouldn't be over spiritual. But then on the other hand, Israel's worship was to be liturgical. It was to be liturgical. It's perhaps not the best word, but what I mean is this. That here are these Israelites, and we've already established they weren't allowed to worship God in the old former Canaanite worship places. They had to worship God in the one place of his choice. And yet, of course, for many of the Israelites, that one place would doubtless be a long way away geographically. It would be a jolly inconvenient thing to have to do, to have to travel to that one place in order to worship God. And surely then, for those people, there could be an exemption. Surely those people could just omit that kind of formal liturgical aspect of worship. Surely those people could just stay at home. Surely in simply enjoying those kind of blessings we've just been mentioning in their normal everyday lives, surely simply in enjoying those, that could be their worship. Surely that would fit with this concern that their worship shouldn't become over-spiritual. Surely there was no need for them to travel to the one place which God had chosen for Israel's worship. Well, certainly Moses does discourage an unreasonable and unnecessary amount of travelling to and from the central sanctuary. So he says then in verse 15 that you may slaughter your animals in any of your towns and eat as much of the meat as you want. And he's saying then you may eat your meat in your towns. You don't need to go to the central sanctuary every time you prepare meat for a meal. The only thing you need to do is not eat the blood. And he goes on to say the same thing again, doesn't he, in verses 20 to 25. When the Lord your God has enlarged your territory as he promised you, and you crave meat and say, I would like some meat, then you may eat as much of it as you want. If the place where the Lord your God chooses to put his name is too far away from you, you may slaughter animals from the herds and flocks the Lord has commanded you. And in your own towns, you may eat as much of them as you want. And again, the only qualification is that you don't eat the blood. So Moses then is very reasonable here. He's discouraging an unnecessary amount of travelling to and from the central sanctuary. But for all that, he's also very clear, isn't he, that there must be some travelling to and from the central sanctuary. That even those Israelites who do live a long way away, They must sometimes go to the one place of God's choice. So verse 17, you must not eat in your own towns the tithe of your grain and new wine and oil, or the firstborn of your herds and flocks, or whatever you have vowed to give, or your free will offerings or special gifts. Instead, you are to eat them in the presence of the Lord your God at the place he will choose. And then again, jump down to verse 26. But take your consecrated things and whatever you have vowed to give and go to the place the Lord will choose. Present your offerings on the altar of the Lord and so on. So even those people who lived a long way away, they did sometimes have to go to the sanctuary and worship God in that formal and liturgical way. They couldn't omit that altogether. That aspect of worship had to be present in their lives. And again, it's the same for us, isn't it? We mustn't seize on 1 Corinthians 10:31, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Or Romans 12:2, therefore I urge you, brothers, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. Or on some idea that, well, because we are temples ourselves of God, the Holy Spirit lives within us, then we're always in the presence of God in the fullest possible sense. Or on the fact that there are so many sermons available to us now on the internet without us leaving our homes even. We mustn't seize on any of that in order to neglect or downplay the importance of the Lord's people gathering together on the Lord's Day in the Lord's presence. Of course, there is important truth contained in those verses. Whatever we do, we should do it for the glory of God. We should, to some degree, view all our activities in life as directed toward the praise and honour of God. But not to the neglect and omission of this more liturgical and formal type of worship. Let us not give up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing. But let us encourage one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching, Hebrews 10:25. These occasions when we gather together for this kind of worship on the Lord's Day, they should still be the high point of the Christian week. And so we too then should aim at this balance that was so important for the Israelites. Worship that isn't over-spiritual in the sense that we're embarrassed about all those normal, everyday blessings that God has given us. We should celebrate those and thank God for those. And yet, on the other hand, worship that is liturgical, that still has this corporate Lord's Day dimension to it. Thirdly, prescribed worship. Prescribed worship. Now, to say that Israel's worship was prescribed by God might seem like something of an understatement. A few years ago, my father toyed with the idea of taking up golf in his retirement. And so he inquired a little, he looked into one or two golf clubs and that kind of thing. But in the end, he just found the whole thing overwhelming because he found it was all so prescriptive at these golf clubs. The clothes that you could and couldn't wear, the equipment that it was absolutely mandatory to have, the etiquette that you had to abide by whenever you walked past a fellow golfer, the places that you could walk and the places that you couldn't walk, it was all just a bit daunting and overwhelming, and so he never took it up. And you read the Old Testament and you read all the material there concerning Israel's worship, and you might think it's a bit similar, that it's a bit over-prescriptive, that virtually every detail down to an Israelite's breathing intervals are prescribed in this worship material in the Old Testament. And we might think, well, why is this? Why is it all so regulated? Why is it all so prescribed? Well, I suppose there are various answers to that question. And ultimately, I guess it lies, does it not, in the very character of God, that God is not some kind of laid-back, vague God who isn't really bothered what goes on. He's a holy God. And it matters then how we approach him and how we worship him. We can't do it any old how, we must do it on his terms. But I think that one reason why Israel's worship was so prescribed is hinted at in the last part of this passage here. Verse 29 onwards, where Moses says, "The Lord your God will cut off before you the nations you are about to invade and dispossess. But when you have driven them out and settled in their land, and after they have been destroyed before you, be careful not to be ensnared by inquiring about their gods, saying, 'How do these nations serve their gods? We will do the same.' You must not worship the Lord your God in their way, because in worshipping their gods, they do all kinds of detestable things the Lord hates. They even burn their sons and daughters in the fire as sacrifices to their gods." In other words then, if human beings are just given a blank sheet of paper, right, you decide how you're going to worship God. You come up with the best way of worshipping God. I think that passage is hinting that human beings never come up with some sophisticated and improved version. But inevitably, if human beings are in the driving seat, if they're deciding how God is to be worshipped, it all degenerates. And it ends up with all kinds of appalling things going on. Just like the Canaanites. They just made up how deity was to be worshipped. And they ended up thinking that it was a good idea that would really impress God to worship, to sacrifice their children on the fire. You see, it's because of the sinfulness of the human heart. That's one reason why Israel's worship had to be prescribed. Because if you just left it to them, they wouldn't come up with something appropriate and suitable and fitting. They would come up with all kinds of appalling things. That's what we are like. We are sinful. And we are disfigured and distorted. And we come up with all kinds of perversions, even when we're trying our best. Hence the Canaanites. And that was why Israel's worship had to be prescribed. And again, it's the same for us. I suppose, in a sense, our worship in the new covenant is not as prescribed as Israel's was. The church of God has come of age. We are adults now, not children, as in the old dispensation. And we have more freedom in one sense. But still it is prescribed, isn't it? And sometimes we might resist that. Well, why only two sacraments? Well, why such an emphasis upon the preaching of the word? Well, why not women in the pulpit preaching on a Sunday? And again, this is one of the answers, isn't it? Because if God left it to us, then we would come up with all kinds of appalling things. It's to restrain our sinful tendencies when it comes to worship that God has prescribed things in so much detail. Fourth and final principle, Christ-centered worship. Christ-centered worship. Now, if the word prescribed was a bit of an understatement, I suppose Christ-centered is perhaps a little bit of an overstatement to say that what we have here in chapter 12 is Christ-centered worship being laid out. Christ, of course, is never mentioned. And we know, don't we, that all the Old Testament worshippers had only a vague and shadowy idea of the Messiah, the Saviour, who was to come. But the reason that I'm using this language is because there's something quite enigmatic, isn't there, about this passage. We have all these references to this one place which God is going to choose as the dwelling place for his name and where Israel are to worship him. Now we know, don't we, that that place is Jerusalem. We know the identity of that place. We know where the temple was going to be built. We know where the glory of God was going to reside. And you kind of think, well, why doesn't Moses just say it? God is inspiring Moses here. God knew that Jerusalem was going to be the place. So why doesn't he just say it? Why this mystery? Why this ambiguity? Why this obscurity? Why doesn't it just say that in Jerusalem you will eventually worship God? Well, I wonder whether it's perhaps a little hint that actually Jerusalem wasn't going to be the worship place forever. A little hint that one day there would be a man in conversation with a woman by a well in Samaria, and that woman would ask that man, "Where should we worship God? Our fathers worshipped on this mountain. You Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem." And the man would respond, "Believe me, woman, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem." And a hint that that same man then, some time later, would die on a cross. And in his death, the Jerusalem temple would be disfigured. The curtain would be torn, signifying that that building was of no further significance. Like so much else in the Old Testament, it had now reached its sell-by date. It had now been fulfilled in this man who was dying on that cross, who was, of course, Jesus Christ. A hint that one day that great fulfillment of the temple would come, as we heard on Wednesday night. And it would be in him that God would be encountered. And it would be in him that God would be met. And it would be in him that God would be worshipped. He would be the ultimate dwelling place of the living God. And again, this then is so applicable to us this morning, isn't it? You see, we don't have one place of worship physically, geographically, like they did. In that sense, all those references to the one place in Deuteronomy 12 are irrelevant to us. Today, on this Lord's Day, millions of Christians will be worshipping God in all kinds of places, scattered all over the world. We don't worship him in one place, but in another sense, we do still worship God in one place. And that one place is Jesus Christ. And apart from Jesus Christ, there's no worship of God. Simply singing hymns does not constitute worship. Simply praying does not constitute worship. Simply reciting the Apostles' Creed does not constitute worship. Simply going to church does not constitute worship. It's only where it's through Jesus Christ, where it's through faith in him, where he is central, where he is the focal point. It's only there that true worship takes place. Still, we all worship God all around the world in one place. And that one place is Jesus Christ. Have you come and ever, therefore, worship God truly? You might have been here lots and lots of times before. You might have sung many, many hymns before. But have you ever worshipped God truly because you've done it through Jesus Christ? If not, you can begin that this morning by coming and placing your faith in him and becoming then a true worshipper of the living God. Amen. We're going to close with a doxology. It's number 90. Now to him who loved us, gave us every pledge that love could give.